Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you, and welcome to all our listeners, tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service, and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. We look like we've got things worked out. I've got Dr. Wollumbi Waters on the line from New Zealand. Wollumbi, how are you?
Yeah, no, I'm good, thank you. It's we got the very very out spray, of that cyclone Pam that hit Vanuatu. So there's been a lot of rain, winds. And thoughts and prayers go out to our South Sea Island community, and any family descendants of, you know, people, you know, and just thinking of that mob, what they went through.
Yes, we've got a lot of family here, you know, South Sea mob and Murray mob and stuff. A lot of family here with their mob over there, Vanuatu, for sure. It's very sad to see that such a paradise, and it's just, destroyed. But they'll come through it. They've been through a cyclone before. They'll come back.
Yeah, no, that's it. You know, there's a adversity of strength amongst our mob around the world, eh?
That's right. Now tell us your mob, your country.
Yeah, I'm again the Gumuroi Warangulda, Kamilroi, Kalban Gunagul. Is my dreaming paths, my song lines, which connect to the water systems, the catchment areas under Baruba Lagoon that go out through the McIntyre River throughout Australia, like them bloodlines, you know, the Baruba being the heart, the pumping heart that pumps that water out from one side of Australia to the other. And that's what we call the Kalban Gunagul, which became our dreaming paths, our song lines, because everywhere mob had to go, they had to know where that water was, you know. So that became the intellectual property and the trade of our mob. Our land area goes all the way Tamworth, Singleton, up through Gunnedah, Moree, Bogbilla, up St. George. Now, St. George, that's my mob. That's where I'm from. My ancestral homelands, and ends around Surat. So pretty, you know, a lot of land there, eh?
There sure is. No, you're very fortunate, all right, to be connected to country like that, to a broad section of country too. Now tell us.
Oh, look, Mum, eh? She made sure that every holidays we were packed up in the car. If we weren't on our way to Moree or Bogabilla, we were driving out to St. George, Gunnedah, you know, Tamworth. There's a big lot of waters at Tamworth. Was embedded into us, you know, exactly our country, where it was.
Yeah, very fortunate.
And that sense of, you know, when you sit at, you know, and you look at that water and you know that your mob, your people, been there for 60, 70,000 years. Nothing like it.
That's right. Whereabouts are you at the moment? You're Auckland, is it?
No, I'm in Hastings.
Hastings.
Which is Hawke's Bay. Ngāti Kahunu, the local iwi, the local tribe here, First Nation. It's one of the most beautiful places in the world.
What are you doing there?
Well, I'm primarily my boy, Niani, got a rugby scholarship to come here. And then I had to juggle things around to give him that opportunity.
That's the young fellow who was at Nadji College?
Yeah. Okay. He was talking about young Tiger the other day, actually. He's starting to miss the boys.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Jake Craigie, you know, talking about Jake Boy as well.
Uh-huh.
you know, it's beautiful. You know, there are real positives coming out of, you know, education and, you know, agency and, you know, developing communities at these schools for our mob. And I could see in the way he was talking about Tiger and Jakey Boy and a couple of the others that they have become mob to him. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, he aligns, he connects with St. George, the Logan community, the Inala mob. But I could see that Nudgee now had become part of that too, mm-hmm. his extended family. Like, he sees himself as a Nudgee Aboriginal.
He deadly, eh?
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So he made the Queensland development side when he was 12, 13. He just made Australian development through their Gold Cup squad. And we were over here visiting family. And he'd always planned to come over here because he wants to be an All Black. That's his dream. Mm. He wants to do that haka, you know? And so the family were all saying, look, you know, why wait till he's 16, 17? You know, why don't you take him up to the schools now? So he went and had a couple of interviews, and, I mean, you know how he presents. He presents very well.
Mm.
We sent some footage over of him playing, and he got a number of offers. So he's on a full-paid scholarship over here. I don't want to put pressure on him or raise expectation. He loves rugby. And he's a charismatic young man. He believes in his culture. And, you know, what will happen will happen.
Yeah.
He's seen it firsthand, you know, his first cousin is Jarrell, state of origin, played for the Broncos in Australia. He loves Vonda, Joe's mum. So he knows the commitment that's required, but also, you know, talking about what happened with Joe, how quickly it can be taken away. So... I don't want to put any extra pressure on him. All I try and do is, with all the kids, is create a conducive environment that allows them to reach their potential.
Most certainly.
Make sure they feel safe and secure. Make sure the homework's done before it's due. You know, give them a balanced life and, you know, they'll do the rest, eh?
Yeah, that's for sure. How does this fit in with your position at Griffith University?
Really well. I've got to say, Griffith University has been very supportive. You know, hey, thank goodness I'm not a self-employed tradie.
I reckon.
I want to take off to New Zealand for 12 months. You know? I met with the Pro Vice-Chancellor, the head of school, Dean of Research. I've got to say that... Paul Mazerol, as the Pro Vice Chancellor, who indirectly runs School of Humanities, Arts Education and Law, met with myself and Professor Gracelyn Smallwood, who's one of my Indigenous mentors in developing my career. And he was very, very supportive in allowing me to come here for a year. I have to look at best practice in regards to the local Māori and how they embed their philosophies into the school curriculum here, which is embedded across all mainstream education. It's very, very impressive. I went to the opening of the school, which starts with a prayer in Māori. All the house names are in Māori. The language is compulsory within the schools. The little fella, Marcus, he made the softballs, the softball team.
Mm-hmm.
And they won their regionals Super 6 competition. No good, eh? All these 12-year-old boys, as soon as they were declared winners, off came their shirts, you know, and the haka started,
oh,
you know.
Oh, good one, eh? Yeah.
And my boy, you know, Aboriginal boy, he was right there in the middle of it, you know, slapping that chest.
Ah, great. Very good.
Deadly.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And they learn the haka. It's at school.
Mm.
He was telling me they have a master of ceremonies of the Māori culture within the school who's given the same authority and status as a deputy headmaster.
All right.
And he's the one who gave the prayer in Māori. He oversees the haka, makes sure that it's done properly.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Marcus was telling me that, you know, he was getting a headache from rolling his eyes back into the back of his head, screaming as loud as he was and, you know, banging on his chest there. And he reckoned, no good, Dad, sir, reckoned, hey, that's not a haka, I'm not even scared.
Mm. Ah, good one, good one.
Made the boys do it again. Oh, it's just, it's so eye-opening, you know, when you come from Australia and you see a Western culture that has totally embraced their indigenous people in the fabric of their society.
Yes, and you look back over here and you see the Western Australian government's threatening to close down communities, quite a number of communities, 150 communities and things like that. What are your thoughts on this one?
Look, this
lifestyle
is,
choices. Yeah, right. Gammon.
Yeah. I mean, wow. I mean, that made the news here. Lifestyle choices.
Yeah, I think it's made the news in a number of international communities, which is good because Australia's beginning to look, well, continuing to look like the laughing stock of the world with this bloke being the leader of the country.
Oh, you know, on every level of equity and human rights violations.
Yeah.
You know, what else made the news here was, you know, his claiming that Australia would not be told or lectured to by the United Nations on its treatment of refugees.
Yeah.
So we're not looking good at the moment internationally. I've also got a US editor because another project I'm working on, which is funding my time over here, is I've got a couple of book contracts with the US. And the editor for the publishing house is an African-American woman who is born in Jamaica, who resides in Miami. And she, too, is just absolutely horrified in regards to what's happening in Australia. And there's a strong international network of Indigenous people around the world who are all watching what's happening back home. There's no doubt. And, you know, our reputation is suffering. There's no doubt about that. I wouldn't be having the opportunities that I do if it wasn't a concern, you know. As well as being here, I'm getting to go back to Ghana this year, which I'm looking forward to. I'm getting to go back to the Caribbean. I'm going to North America, Canada, to be with Cree Stoney and talk to them. All about the concerns in relation to what's happening in Australia, you know?
Very good. Those people need to hear direct from the horse's mouth, so to speak, directly from our mob.
Well, Australia doesn't realise. They're so dismissive, the mainstream culture of Aboriginal culture and its true history and, you know, its innovation prior to colonisation, that they don't understand the significance that Indigenous people give to our mob as the oldest living culture in the world. That is recognised. Let me tell you, when I was fortunate enough to be in Ghana and Africa and the Caribbean, you know, these people acknowledge and recognise that. Like, you know, the latest DNA research shows that we have a pure cluster DNA of Aboriginal and African that is unique because we left Africa through migration, through the Genome Project, 30,000 years prior to the other mobs who left Africa, who settled around Europe and Asia. So there's a direct line between the Australian Aboriginal and the African from, you know, the oldest known origins of humanity. Now, science is catching up with what Indigenous people already knew inherently through their dreaming because, you know, the dreaming is a universal concept. When you go to other Indigenous cultures and you talk to them, you know, you understand that the biodiversity, the land management, you know, the need to be in harmony with your surroundings, understanding your environment, your kinship systems and obligation to land, these are universal concepts, you know. And in that creation, there is certain stories which are universal, the Seven Sisters creation story, you know. And what that does is that creates a term of reference. So that is acknowledged by Indigenous people around the world. So they're very concerned the way the oldest living people in the world are being treated, because that affects their line of genetic memory and history through their song lines, their dreaming stories, you know. And this is a parallel history and reality that never stopped. Colonization believes that, you know, they destroyed Indigenous cultures. Well, they didn't. And what you see internationally is a vibrant renaissance in indigeneity and Aboriginal ways of thinking. Even the Cree Stoney, talking to them, getting ready for my trip, they've even stopped using the term First Nation, and they're going back to Aboriginal.
Really?
Because they want to be known as Aboriginal nations because of the strength of that word and being the first, Aboriginal, you know? So when you hear the ignorance, you know, you're not dismayed by, you know, the statement that Tony Abbott made in regards to remote communities being a lifestyle choice. You know, this just confirms the dismissing and the arrogance of, you know, European hegemony as a sense of superiority. It confirms his earlier statements in regards to Australia being nothing but bush, you know, before Europeans arrived. It just shows that this man has a total Eurocentric look at the world and a sense of racial superiority. When he said that he wanted to be the Prime Minister for Aboriginal people, it was never in regards to getting his hands dirty, walking on soil, you know, getting that red dirt between his toes and listening with Aboriginal people. It was totally as the patriarch, the white man, who was going to save our mob and make the hard decisions, you know, which we were unable to make because we're primitive and savage. And that comes across again and again with everything that he says.
One of the things I liked with what was the outcry against him, I mean, Pearson, Mundine, and others came out strong against him. You saw some of that over there?
Oh, look, most definitely. And, you know, to see our people galvanised, to see those who, you know, are on opposite sides of the political fence developing a sense of consensus against, you know, the practices of what is effectively cultural genocide and removing people from their traditional homelands is inspiring.
It's really nice to see because, like you say, people from the opposite sides of the political fence being galvanised on this particular issue, the continuing destruction of our culture, our people, our communities, the assimilation, the genocidal practices. Our mob are being galvanised on this particular issue, and I just thought it was great. Even Stan Grant, on air on his program, was pretty strong in his comments. Ernie Dingo, another one.
Oh, look, I don't know if people have seen Ernie's Twitter. It's one of the ways I keep touch with the blackfellas. I don't do social media, but I jump on, you know, Twitter and all the rest just to see what, you know, Marty is thinking and, you know, where Ernie's at. And Nakua Louie is another one who I love, you know, the young Gomeroi girl writer who's part of black comedy. Sensational political writer she is, Nakua Louie. Playwright. But Ernie Dingo, wow, I don't know if you've seen his Twitter. He's talking about, you know, Western government, West Australian government, you're going to rot in hell. He's you know, telling it as it is. He's talking about, you know, how much, you know, uranium and gas and oil deposits are there underneath this land. What's going to happen once, you know, the people are removed? You know, and that's fascinating because, you know, in Ernie, you've got this incredibly talented individual, this artist, who, you know, really did sacrifice a lot during the renaissance of, you know, the political movement to represent our mob in mainstream television. Now, nobody would know personally the sacrifices that would have entailed and, you know, the in-house racism that he would have had to have put up with to have become the face of Australia. He's a dignified man. He's a strong, powerful Aboriginal man. And to see the venom in his comments really shows that, that he is also a WA Noongar, you know. This is a man talking about his country, which is why I believe it's so personalised. Look, I agree. You know, Aboriginal people have every right to an education. Aboriginal people have every right to come to the urban centres and benefit from all there is in modern society. But Aboriginal people also have every birthright to lay claim to their traditional homeland. Okay, that's not negotiable. And the state that these homelands are in, the state that these communities are in, are an absolute disgrace. And the reason that you have communities of 40, 50, 60, 100 people is because they have never, ever had the infrastructure, the resource, the development required for these Aboriginal people to participate in modern-day life that we take for granted on the eastern seaboard side. You know, there was a responsibility and obligation from the Australian government to cater to the needs of every Australian citizen. And that was never granted to our traditional Aboriginal people. When you look at the history too, you know, of what happened with these homeland movements, what happened with these people going back out to country, the truth is that after Vincent Lingari and everyone celebrated the great protests for equal wages, you know, on Aboriginal lands, for the stockmen, you know, the fencers, the people who built this country. You know, what people don't realise is that rather than give the full wages, these Aboriginal workers were let go. Now, we're talking about 50, 60 years ago, okay? And when they were let go, these were people who had employment. These were people who were feeding families. You know, who should have been given every entitlement of non-Indigenous people. They were forced out into these communities because there was no work. Why was there no work? Because the pastoralists refused to give them full wages that they were entitled to support their families. That's where these communities developed. That's the history behind them. They went home out to their traditional communities. The kids and the children's children for need to be part of modern society, to be given the opportunities for education, started leaving. And we've all felt it. We've all been part of it. You know, my wife is a traditional owner of Malawali Kalawali in Bulya. Now, she's a project manager. She has first cousins who are some of the best administrators in Aboriginal affairs in this country, none of who can afford to go and live out in Bulya. And yet Bulya is crying out for that type human capital, that type of agency, that productivity.
That's right, for those skills, yeah.
Exactly, yet there is no funding or resources for these amazing professional Aboriginal women, administrators, managers, project managers to go home.
Yeah. Listen, I've got a caller on the line. Stay with me. Sarah, welcome to the program. How are you?
Thank you. Fine. I remember watching a documentary in Alaska, or based in Alaska, of people who wanted to live up near the Arctic Circle. So the children that were there, and those, and they weren't even communities. They were just like a husband and wife, a couple of kids living in a house.
Going bush.
They went bush. The government set up that if the parents homeschooled them, at the government's expense, once every 6 months, they would fly a teacher to spend a few days with that family. May only have one child, may have three children. Mm. At the government's expense, they flew the teachers there to assess how the kids were progressing, do little exams or whatever. The parents put them up. The government paid for it all.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, here we are. He's bitching about, you know, a cluster of people living and doesn't want to provide services.
Mm.
I can't understand it, how one government will bend over backwards to allow white people to live wherever they wanted. They weren't penalised for it. It was their choice. But the government bent over backwards to make sure that the children had an education. They had a mail service that went through once a week, I think. Government paid for it. They just dropped the mail. No one, you know, the plane didn't always land.
Yeah, yep, just drop
but
it.
But the services were provided.
Yes. Yes, no, it's outrageous. It's this, and I think it's in the history of this country, the colonising of the country where they came in and trampled on the rights of First Nations people. And it's still that mentality today, still trampling on our rights, not recognising.
I'm a white person from New Zealand. Mm. I read that book about black seed. What an eye-opener that was.
What was the book?
What an eye-opener. That, you know, the black seed, the cultivation or whatever.
Yes.
That was a wonderful book.
Wasn't it a fantastic book? Dark Seed.
To me, that should be compulsory reading in all schools, primary and secondary.
Most certainly.
For whatever reason. They've got the technology here, German-made buses, where they have a dental clinic, a GP clinic, a small surgery room. Why can't they get one of those buses and just travel around, whether it be Queensland, Northern Territories, Western Australia, just do a once a fortnight or once a month circular trip, take care of everybody's medical needs?
Yeah.
How hard would it be?
Yes, no, I don't think it's been well thought out. I don't think they can afford to shut down communities here, and I've said it on here a number of times. They haven't thought it through. They really can't afford, and they don't have the infrastructure in place, just like they did with the Indigenous Advancement Strategy funding. They didn't have the infrastructure in place to deal with it.
As you said earlier in the week, some of these communities don't even have government services.
That's right. That's right.
To start with. So what are they going to shut down if it's not already there?
It's terrible. It's not good.
Yeah, but I agree with you. It's
the more people like
I can't understand the logic of the man. I really can't.
No, there's no logic there. That's right. Yep.
No.
All right. Thanks for your call, eh?
Okay, thanks for the time. Bye.
Have a good day. Yes, that's...
You know, you raise a really good point there. And that is that, you know, these 12,000 to 20,000 people, they're not going to disappear.
That's right.
Like, they're still going to need funding. Infrastructure wherever they go.
That's right.
And at the moment, let's be real, the government is spending a pittance. What infrastructure are you planning in Alice Springs, in Broome?
How are they going to be housed? Where are they going to be housed?
Exactly. Mount Isa.
Health.
You know, because that's where you're going to go from WA through the Northern Territory. You're going to end up in Broome. You're going to end up in Alice Springs, you know. These are the major centres that they're talking about. Well, what's the planning and the infrastructure and the employment that's there ready for these mobs to come?
None whatsoever. As if there's jobs there. They're talking about going to school, you know. They've got to close them down in order to, one, have kids going to school, two, have parents with jobs, and three, make safer communities. I mean, this safer communities thing is another one that's going under the radar. And it's ridiculous. It's outrageous. I've got another caller on the line. Let's see who we have. Welcome to Let's Talk. Welcome. Who have we got?
Yeah, morning, Tiger.
What's your name?
My name's Neil.
Neil, what would you like to say, Neil?
This might be a very simplistic solution, but and something I've always wondered, because I've spent a lot of time working in places like Africa, Papua New Guinea, and I've seen a lot of, shall we say, how traditional landowners have dealt with the situation.
Mm.
Why is it there is no Aboriginal political party?
Yeah, there's been some tried. Leave it to us and we'll give you an answer between the two of us.
Because I think, I mean, if you did that, surely then you know, all your mob would vote for that. You'd promote your interests and surely that would be the best way of trying to achieve.
Well, yes and no. Yes and no. I don't think so because, one, we're only 3% of the population and we may have another 2 or 3% of the mainstream population supporting us. We still don't have the numbers. We don't have economic power. We don't have political power. And to have a political party, I don't think is going to give us the political power that we need. But it is a start. I mean, there's a range of things that need to be done, my friend, you know, and that is one of them. There have been a number of attempts at political parties. There have been a number of attempts. There's a number of our people that are elected into state parliaments as we speak, Western Australia, Northern Territory, New South Wales, Queensland. But those people still have to go against the grain of party politics and what have you, you know?
Yeah, but I suppose to re-establish fairness, equity, and justice for what's been done in the past, then you need to have some way of advancing, I suppose, your point of view, which isn't being done at the moment. And I think you may only be 3% of the population, but how many, I think, of the mainstream population would vote for an Aboriginal party? I think there would be an awful lot.
There may well be, because there's a lot of mainstream population, a lot of good people out there that want to see change, and that they want to see justice. They want to see the right thing being done by humanity.
Well, that's all you want to see, isn't it?
Yes.
It's not a case of anything to do with skin colour, religion, or anything else. It's just right being done.
It's right. That's right. Alison, thanks for your call, buddy.
My pleasure.
You have a good day.
Bye-bye.
What are your thoughts on that one, Marcus? A political party.
He raises a very good point, and that you know, ultimately, and this is what we're talking about in the way the world is looking at Australia at the moment, is that this is not about race in the end, eh? This is humanity and equity. You know, this is about the treatment of your fellow man and your woman, your sister's daughters, you know? And that's what, you know, Australians have got to realise, you know, and this movement could really, really start. If you can galvanise and you can develop unity within our community, as diverse as it is, with, you know, the people who were sitting in absolute polar opposites politically, if you can unite, you know, the Marcia Langtons, the Noel Pearsons, you know, the Ernie Dingoes, you know, the Tiger Bales on this issue, the Stan Grants, my goodness, you then start to get a groundswell of non-Indigenous support. Because the real problem here, and, you know, I'll differ to what our mate was saying, is that, you know, be careful when you start talking about the wrongs of history. This is now. You know, these people ended up out in these communities because of what happened years ago, when, you know, their fathers weren't given equal rights and fair pay.
Oh, when they weren't allowed to go step inside of school grounds. Weren't you allowed to enrol in schools? Yeah.
Now, that might be 50 years ago, but the consequences are of the children today who were children then, and the way they're rearing their children in these communities that have absolutely no infrastructure or resources. So, you know, be careful when you start talking about, you know, the wrongs of the past, because the wrongs of the past, you know, affect what's happening today, and there's no better circumstance than this call to end Aboriginal remote communities in Western Australia. The other thing you said that was very, very important before our caller is the way that Barnett is using child safety as an excuse, unsafe communities for the children.
Mm.
How many times have we heard that rolled out?
Oh, far too many. Mm.
You know, the intervention, you know, again, let's talk about the intervention statistics of exactly how many males were charged for sexual abuse. I think there was 4.
Yeah.
And I don't think there was 1 conviction.
Mm.
Yet the intervention is still there, you know. So the moment you start hearing these guys talking about child safety, child protection, you know, that's when, you know, the alarm's got to start going off and go, okay, what's really going on here? You know, these are real emotive discourse to allow the absolute degradation of civil and human rights, which is the very basis of equity within what you would want to believe is a democratic system. Now, Aboriginal people who have been living on land with kinship ties, which is indisputable, by the way, this one's not negotiable, which go back tens of thousands of years, have every right to maintain that kinship system.
Cultural responsibilities.
Exactly. Exactly.
Custodial responsibilities.
Custodial obligation responsibilities.
Yes, yes.
And the Australian government has to treat those people with the same priority it treats Eastern Seaboard, Sydney, Manly beaches.
Yeah.
You know, okay, you know, we can talk about income generation and all the rest, but
didn't this come out of the fact that there is a massive debt? Well, who accumulated the debt?
Yeah.
Not the people living in remote communities in WA. Why aren't we hitting the high end? Why aren't we hitting the big businesses and asking for fair taxes?
The big corporations, yes.
To make up the what's missing, you know? That's where the gap is. Why don't we hit all the families who have trust accounts who aren't paying full tax? Why aren't we hitting them? You know, why is government not willing to fund, which is, you know, a drop in the ocean, let's be honest, in regards to, you know, total expenditure of a Western developed country, why are they not willing to fund tens of thousands of years of custodial obligation on traditional lands, which has created the situation that we have today, not in the past, today, and yet they're willing to fund millions of dollars towards a mining industry?
Yeah, yeah.
That we know is not sustainable. That we know that every forecast, be it economical or environmental, tells you that fossil fuel is redundant.
That's right. That's right. But who's to say that there is jobs in these centres? The unemployment rate in this country is the highest it's been for quite a long time. So that doesn't count as a reason to move. Who's to say that the schools, the education system, is able to cater to an influx, to an expansion of their numbers? Who's to say the resources are there for that? We know damn well that there's no housing available because of the town black, city blacks are already, they're overcrowded and not being catered to sufficiently for housing. So that's, again, this has not been thought through. It's a knee-jerk reaction, it's buck passing, and it's political football, where blacks are wearing the brunt of it.
You just hold your head in dismay. It's very important now that we've found a base of solidarity, now that we're becoming, and this is, I can't, you know, state this enough, you know, the diversity of our people who are coming together. You know, I was on Anita Heiss's tweet this morning, you know, reading her, and she, along with everybody else, was talking about how unjust, you know, the attack on human rights as Aboriginal people, racist legislation, you know. These are really, really strong-minded, focused, professional Aboriginal people. You know, we have been crying out for this type of leadership, unity and solidarity within our community. You know, let's utilize this position. Let's mobilize as one. Let's start to generate support within, you know, non-Indigenous community, those who support fair play, equity and justice. You know, and let's make a real stand here.
Yes,
you know,
no, I think it's a good point that we must come together on this one and work our, forget our differences, work out what the common goal, common thread is. Look, I've got another caller on the line. Veronica, welcome to the program. How are you?
Good morning, Tiger, and your very astute commentator. I'm sorry, I missed the first part. Tiger, basically I just wanted to mention that I rang a few days ago and said, look, we have internet, we have social media, let's use it. There's been massive amount of positive action, which actually helped to have the meetings last week on Friday.
Mm.
And there are a lot of people out there supporting. And this is really about human rights and social justice. It's got nothing to do with race.
That's right. It is. You're right.
And human rights and social justice does not exist for the Indigenous people in this country.
Yes, no, there's a good utilisation of social media at the moment, which is really good. So it's really good to see.
Absolutely. So, you know, Facebook is one that I follow all the time. It goes out on Twitter, and no doubt there's other things that are there. But people are getting together, they're uniting, and that's the only way that
most
it can
certainly
be done.
Thank you for your call.
We've got to keep up the pressure.
Yes, we do. Thank you for your call.
All the very best to everybody.
And yourself. Bye now.
Thank you. Bye.
Yes, Wallumbi, it's a... I think here we need to try and, I don't know how we do it, but we need to harness the energy and the support that is there, the commonality that is there between the opposing individuals and people are all coming to have all got the same view, and I'd really like to see that being harnessed. Come together, think tank, sit down together and start working. Get Marcia in on it. Get Warren. Get Pearson. Get people to sit down and start to strategize on this.
It has to happen, because the reason we've got to this situation is that there's no governing term of reference for what it means to be Aboriginal in that country. There's that country, I reckon, already claiming New Zealand. What does it mean to be Aboriginal? Where do you go to for your rite of passage? Where do you go to develop an alternative income, source of management, philosophy to life? You know, who nurtures you as an urban Aboriginal, as a remote Aboriginal, in regards to your sense of place and well-being? Okay? There is no term of reference which is agreed upon by our own people which nurtures the next generation, what it actually means to be Aboriginal and what leadership forums are available for us to take action to advance our own people. This is an opportunity to finally come together round table of, you know, some very, very powerful, highly focused, professional Indigenous leaders from within the community, not nominated by non-Indigenous government agency, but Aboriginal people who have agency, who have the capacity to come together and say, right, let us now develop a term of reference of what is, what isn't a traditional community. What is customary obligation to?
Yes.
Because I'll tell you what, Native Title didn't do it. All that did was create division.
Oh, yeah, that created some terrible division. Well, I've got another caller on the line, Selwyn. Welcome to the program, Selwyn. How are you?
Thank you. Yeah, I like the Eamon comment about why Tony Abbott will never be circumcised. I like that. But anyway, Tiger,
there's no end to the prick.
Yeah.
All right.
Tiger, I heard you talk about humanity, and, you know, there's a commonality, you know, the bikies, when they brought that legislation about the bikies.
Yes, anti-bikie laws.
It's not about them and the farmers, you know, where they get our liquid gas, the white farmers.
Yes, yes.
So there is a commonality, and I think that's the closest thing we ever got to Wounded Knee is that documentary about Arakoon, the takeover documentary, Tiger.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, when they armed themselves up there in Arakoon, the takeover documentary?
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah, I think that's the closest we ever got to Wounded Knee, eh?
Yeah, I think you're right.
Okay then, Tiger.
Yep. All right, brother. Thanks for your call. Bye now. Selwyn from Cairns, and a warm cheerio to all the Bumabipra media fans and listeners. It's great.
You know, we have some of the best young original journalists in this country right now.
Most certainly.
All women. You know, we've already talked about Nakia Louie, who is an incredible political writer. Her social commentary is right on the ball of what's happening in this country. And then you've got Celeste Little, who writes for The Guardian, as well as Nikki.
So how do we pull these people together? How do we utilise this?
That's right, because, you know, here is our reference point. You know, yes, no matter where you are born in this country, Arakoon, Palm Island, Cairns, Redfern, you have a right to move into a city centre, to become gainfully employed and develop an education. But you also have a right to your traditional homeland. And by acknowledging that right, we become richer as a nation. That's what people don't realise. And that's what I witness when I go overseas. That's what I'm witnessing here in New Zealand at the moment, is that when you have diversity and acceptance of multi-spoken language in the classroom, you have a richer culture. You have a more vibrant culture. My boys are coming home not just speaking Māori and Gamilaroi, they're coming home speaking Tongan, Fijian,
because each and every culture is accepted in the classroom. How many cultures do we have today in Australian classrooms? And yet we are continually teaching the Eurocentric way of life with a sense of superiority to colonization, buried in a past which is carried through the trauma of Gallipoli and Anzac sacrifice. This is traumatic stuff. This, if you don't mind, coming from left field, have you been watching that show Gallipoli?
No, mate, I can't watch that stuff.
Well, I've been watching it over here. We all know that our boys, our Aussie boys, were cannon fodder to protect the British. That's written in history now. But the way they captured it, when these Aussie boys were made to go over the trenches and 20,000 were being shot within 10 feet, this was not any glory. There was nothing brave or to be admired. This was a suicide pact ordered as a massacre of young Australian boys by an English crown.
You know, it was just outrageous. Well, I just can't watch that sort of stuff. There's too much colonial history. And anyway, we're getting close to the end of the program.
What it does,
mate,
Uncle Tiger, is it highlights the trauma and the damage done to the psyche of the non-Indigenous people
to
colonise this land. And here is a real opportunity for healing. If we come together, embrace the Indigenous culture, and realise that our...
Mate, I've got to go. Humanity. I've got to go. News is on me. Thank you for joining us.
You,
have
Uncle.
A good one.
Bye
now.